there was a young woman who was baptized, and she was a first-time guest the week before, and then she got baptized. She studied with a few... Morgan. She studied with Jay and Vicky Morgan, gave her life to the Lord, and then 2 weeks later, Eileen got baptized. And she had been thinking about it for decades. And seeing this young woman, Caitlin, get baptized gave her the courage to do that as well. And so I do encourage doing this publicly as much as possible, because I think it's helpful. Okay, let's get started. I'm going to open us up with prayer, and then we're going to jump in. Father, thank you so much for the men and women in this room and the people who are thinking about what their baptism means or about putting you on in baptism. I pray your spirit would be here, that you would help us to be able to discern your will for our lives and give ourselves to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, come on in, y'all. So when I first started working at a church, full-time, I met this kid named Brandon, who was just a couple of years younger than me. And Brandon, I was like 21, he was like 19. Brandon had never been to church before in his life. And he decides he's going to give himself to the Lord in baptism. And he doesn't know anything else except that Jesus wants him to do this, so he's going to do it. So it's in the middle of a service on a Wednesday night, and Brandon, the praise team is singing, and the song is ending. And so Brandon says to me, "Hasaba hasaba," and I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Hasaba hasaba," and I didn't understand. And they had just stopped singing the song, and so I just go, "Yeah, yeah." And I go down in there. But what apparently he had said was, "Am I supposed to be on my knees to do this?" Because Brandon and I were about the same height, and now we get out there, and I'm like, "Church, this is," and I see Brandon, who's just barely keeping it. And so I'm like, "Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God?" And Brandon's like, "That's a real thing." And so I honestly, one of my first baptisms at that church, I was just like, you know, and just like a... So I do think it's important to know what it is happening when you get baptized. Because baptism, but the challenge of it is, and this is why it was so challenging to write this, baptism is not something you wrap your mind around. It is a mystery. That's actually the word that's used to describe it, along with words like to describe marriage. It's a mega mystery. There will never be, if you've ever thought, "I just don't know enough." Here's the thing. Every time I learn something new about God, I would get baptized every day, because baptism is not something you learn into. It's something you learn out of. It's a mega mystery. It's a window that you look through, not a window you look to. That's things that are... This is a different way of thinking about it, especially for Americans, because like things like communion, marriage, baptism, it's ultimately about God. But it does beg the question, why does anybody do this? Because this is a weird thing to do. If you weren't in the Bible Belt and raised religious, you would be saying, "Why does anybody do this?" Because you're basically bathing in public, right? You say some words, somebody gives you a quick bath, and then a lot of people clap. That's a weird thing, right? If you were just coming in from the outside, you would think that was weird. A few months ago, this really happened. The Roman Catholic Church, there was a priest who had been baptizing people for decades, and he had been using what they saw as the wrong words. Have y'all heard this? This was a national story, because they called all the people, hundreds, maybe thousands of people that he had baptized, and said, "Hey, your baptisms aren't valid." Which, can you imagine those phone calls? Like, "Hey, Bob, we've got some bad news. Oh, this isn't Bob? Oh, Bob's no longer with us? Then we've got some really bad news," right? So what saves us? Do we need saving? What do we need saving from? And does baptism have anything to do with that? So first off, we live in a disenchanted world. I want to start there, because when I say things like demons and angels and stuff like that, that's probably a little bit hard for the modern American person to believe. So let's start with this. If you were to put the water that's in our... Come on in, you guys. If you were to put the water that's in our baptistry under a microscope, you would see normal H2O water, okay? The same way that if you were to put the hay that Jesus was born in and laying on, if you were to put that under a microscope, you just see normal hay. If you were just put the water in the Jordan River that Jesus was baptized into underwater, you just see like muddy H2O. If you were to put the cross, the wood on the cross, under a microscope, you just see normal wood. Because the Christian faith does not come to us from outside of our lived experience. It comes to us in our lived experience. It's the very stuff of life that reveals who God is and it sustains us. So stuff like bread and wine and water. So in order to see baptism as a enchanted thing that you're actually doing, let me talk to you about this. This is going to be weird, this first part, but I think it's important. In the Netflix show, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, a few years ago, there was a scene of Sabrina the witch and a dark baptism, which is really a thing. It's really a thing that people who are in the Wiccan church do to surrender themselves to the power of Satan and get baptized in the name of Satan. That's really a thing. Now, if I was to ask most Americans what baptism is, we would say something like, well, it's a symbol, right? The same way that this is a symbol of my love for my wife and vice versa. Yeah, that's true. But if you, we have an impoverished view of symbols, because if I was to ask you, would you get baptized into the name of Satan? Chances are 100% of people in this room would be like, no, that doesn't sound like something I would want to do. And I would ask, why not? Because if it's just a symbol, if it's just an empty symbol, then what does that really matter? You would say, I don't want to be identified with Satan. I do not want to be marked out as Satan's own. A Satanist, on the other hand, would gladly be baptized in the name of Satan because Satanist spirituality is to be in union with Satan and his purposes in the world. So it's easier to see baptism from that perspective when you grew up with it, with just watching people do it. You start to understand, oh, this really does mean something. It means something significant. It reveals our union to Jesus and establishes a new identity, and it opens up a window for God's vision for your life in this world. Now, this is a part that's even weirder. So there is a Church of Christ preacher named Milton Jones. How many of y'all have heard of Milton Jones? Anybody? Okay, just Josh. All right, Milton Jones preaches in Portland and Seattle. He's in the Northwest for decades, and this is a true story, at least from him. So Milton Jones is a friend. He's a reputable guy. He goes around the world feeding lots of hungry people these days. That's what he does. That's who he is. And this is a story from about 20 years ago. There was a woman who was a part of a Wiccan community in Portland, because Portland's very post-Christian and has been for a long time. She gets invited to church on a Saturday night, and she feels the Spirit of God. This woman would self-identify as a witch. She feels the Spirit of God. She studies with people and gets baptized. And a couple of days later, her boyfriend, who was also in that community, comes to the church and accosts Milton. And he's like, where is she? What have you done? And he's making threats and stuff. And I'm sure there's people in that community that are not violent or anything, so I'm not trying to. But this really happened, according to Milton. And he was like, where is she? And Milton was so scared for him and the staff that he told her where she was. And he's turned around in a huff. He's angry. He's walking out. And before he goes, he says, wait, you guys didn't baptize her, did you? And he said, yes. And he says, well, then there's nothing I can do now. And walks away. Now, I open with that story because honestly, I struggle intellectually to believe this, but I also believe it. I've seen human beings up close and personal for a few decades now, and I believe that there is something at work more than just the sum of our choices, right? I've seen addiction and despair and abuse, and I don't know another word to describe it than evil. Because, and I don't know if you've had this experience, but if you're around people who have done things that everybody in society agree is evil at the time, like child abuse or human trafficking, when the smoke clears, if you spend time with these people, and I have, you just see a normal person. They're not the monster you think they are. So, for example, I did jail ministry in Fort Worth for a long time. And at one point, a year or two into it, I found out that this guy, who they called the shoestring killer, because he killed people with shoestrings, was Brother Richard. He was in our jail pod, God pod, we called it. And I was like, okay, Brother Richard is the shoestring killer. And when I brought this up to him, he was like, man, I just got carried away. It's like, oh, okay, that's a thing that can happen to normal human beings. Because the guy had a normal job. I'm telling you, these people aren't monsters. So when you open up the Gospels, you enter into a strange world. Like, I think a world that's more accurate representation of reality than what we assume is reality. And on every gospel, when you open up, you're like, I want to learn about Jesus. The gospels, every single one of them are like, but first, demons. Which is weird. Because contrary to what a lot of us think, the Bible is not wall-to-wall supernatural stuff. It's not. In fact, the very first exorcism that happens is Jesus in the gospels. In like Mark chapter 1, he kicks out somebody, by the way, in the synagogue, in church. And so Jesus does battle with demons a lot. And that's not usual in the Bible. Huge chunks of the Bible are just kind of normal, this world events. You know, stuff that's in history. But then there's Jesus. And he doesn't live in some like Middle Earth Narnia. Right? He lives in 4 BC and 32 AD, something like that, with real historical characters. Jesus's world is our world, but according to Jesus, it's not the only world. And every now and then, this stuff that is unseen breaks out and affects our world, kind of like the mafia, right? The underground, like in 1972 in Manhattan. The mob boss, Crazy Joe Gallo, got executed in a seafood restaurant that was crowded, and nobody knew all this tension was going on. It's kind of like that. I start here because there's a guy named Francis Schaeffer who did a lot of work with college students a couple of decades ago, and he used to preach to college students who were secular and non-believing, and he would start the first sermon he preached to them would always be on angels, and people would ask him why. And he said, because if I don't, then when I talk about Jesus and God and sin, people think I'm talking about morality. Like, this is a way you can just get more moral. But in a moment, we're going to talk about salvation and forgiveness and purpose and meaning and all that. But I want to start here because this is not just more of the same stuff you're used to. There is a sense that you're entering into a different story when you get baptized, like the wardrobes of Narnia. And there's also a sense that every baptism is also an exorcism. And I know that sounds strange, but I mean it. It is renouncing the spiritual forces that you are the most susceptible to. So let me put some words on that. Things like greed. You can't stop consuming. Vanity. You're so concerned with what other people think about you. The excessive concern of it. Envy. Or always looking to your left or right and making sure that you're better than somebody else. Or feeling crushed by somebody having a life you wished you had. Wrath. Or anger at people. Impatience. Gluttony. Which, by the way, can be way more than food. It can be tobacco, alcohol. The inability to deny yourself pleasure in the present because it's going to undermine your future. Lust. Trying to use people. That's not just a sex thing. Okay, so with that said, let's get started. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. And God called the dry ground land. Okay, so that's the creation story. God separates the world and the Holy Spirit hovers over the waters, and then God creates dry ground. That's the way it starts off. Okay, the very next book in the Bible is what? Exodus, that's right. Genesis is written to the people who are just coming out of Exodus, right? So the people who are hearing the stories about their forefathers and foremothers are learning that they eventually drifted into slavery. and that God has, through Moses, come to deliver his people from slavery. Now, this stuff has just happened in the book of Exodus when it's first being told. And God, through Moses, goes to Pharaoh and says, "These are my people, let my people go." And so Pharaoh says, "No." And God breaks all the powers of Pharaoh, the spiritual powers of Pharaoh, because he had 9 bows. It's a longer story. God sends 10 plagues, breaking every one of the powers of Pharaoh. Anyway, so then God, they're going to get delivered, and they're headed out of Egypt, and then all of a sudden they're between the Red Sea and Pharaoh's army behind them, because Pharaoh changed his mind. And then the people are complaining, "Look what you've done. We're going to either die by drowning or we're going to die by getting killed by Pharaoh's army." And this happens in Exodus. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us?" Is this microphone on? It's not working, is it? Sorry.
It's pointing the wrong way.
Okay. They said to Moses, "There was no graves in Egypt. You brought us into the desert to die. What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'?" Which, by the way, this says a lot about human nature, doesn't it? Hey, look, the slave master you know is better than the one you don't. "It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Then Moses answered, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring to you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." And then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground." Now, where have you first heard dividing the water and dry ground? Genesis. Chapter 1, verse 1, right out of the gate. What's happening to the Israelites is not just that they are being delivered from slavery. It's that they are being delivered to be a new creation. There are things that every human being has, habits that they can't stop. And every one of those is different to the human, right? You hate it, but you can't stop doing it. And then God. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen this in ministry. Sometimes it's through 12-step groups. Sometimes it's through 242 groups. Sometimes it even happens in our assemblies. But it can happen anywhere because God is in this business. He's in the Exodus business. And they walk through on dry ground. This is a fresh start, a clean break, a new beginning, and a new purpose. That doesn't mean that your life has to be a dumpster fire in order for you to get baptized. But it does mean that you have to recognize in yourself the same thing that is common to all human beings, that left to your own devices, it's not going to go well. So Jeffrey Dahmer is back in pop culture because of some Netflix thing, but he was a guy who killed a lot of people and did some really bad stuff. And he finally was caught after murdering several people, and he was on death row. He was going to die. And there's somebody in our fellowship who I don't know, but is a friend of a friend. And my friend's like, "Yeah, he's just a normal guy. Like, teaches Bible class every now and then, but he's just a normal guy." He's like, he teaches in Nashville at a school. He's a school teacher. But when he hears him and this older woman, when they hear about Jeffrey Dahmer doing this horrible thing, you know what he thinks? That guy needs to know the Lord. And he and this woman reach out to Jeffrey Dahmer, and Jeffrey Dahmer got baptized. That means he's a brother in the Lord. And I have had stories or Bible studies with people who are interested in baptism, and I tell them that story, and they're like, "I'm out." Seriously, like they stop because they don't want to have anything to do with the heaven that Jeffrey Dahmer is a part of. And okay, that makes sense to me. That totally makes sense. If you think that you are going to get saved because you can look to your left and look to your right and see somebody who's a little bit worse than you or a lot worse than you, wherever you happen to be, then you're probably not wanting this story. You're probably not wanting this reality, and you're probably not wanting to get baptized. I do think baptism is something that happens when you are self-aware enough that left to your own devices over time, you are going to self-destruct. I didn't know what kind of demographic this group was going to be, so I decided to describe it this way. In the words of the great theologian, Taylor Swift, "It's me. Hi. I'm the problem. It's me. It's me. Everybody agrees." And then, I'm looking at this table over here, if y'all can help me finish this out. I stare directly in the sun, but never in the... Chris! I stare directly in the sun, but never in the mirror. You realize that you break stuff. You break promises, relationships, moods, stuff you don't want to break. And if you realize that, it's humbling. Baptism is always humbling because the root of all sin is pride. One of the more interesting stories in the Old Testament, trust me, we're going to get to Jesus in the New Testament in just a little bit, but it's this guy named Naaman, who is a 5-star general. He is a general for Assyria, and he's a big deal, serves at the right hand of the king, and Naaman gets diagnosed with leprosy. And when you get diagnosed with leprosy, especially in the ancient world where there's no cure, you have to be away from everybody, all of a sudden, it doesn't matter how many stars you have on your lapel or how many degrees or trophies you have. It's a death sentence, and there's no amount of power that can protect him from it. But he gets a tip from a servant girl that is in his household that he should go to Israel and talk to a prophet of God. And so there's normally no way that somebody like Naaman would do this because Israel is a country that he had conquered. And this is a servant girl who was one of the spoils of war who's telling him about this. But you can see his desperation that he's willing to do this. So he goes to Israel's kind of puppet king, and he goes, the king of Syria sends him with a letter from the king. So Naaman goes, takes a lot of money, you know, a lot of stuff, and he says, the king is asking you to heal, you know, whatever, do your jujitsu stuff and get my general healed. And the king of Israel reads the letter from the king that has defeated him and tears his robe and says, "Am I God? Can I bring back to life? Why are you bringing them to me to be cured of his leper?" And he's trying to fight with me. To which you read this and you're like, all right, maybe switch to the decaf, king of Israel. But then Elisha, the prophet, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes and said, "Why have you torn your robes? Have him come to me and he will know there's a prophet in Israel." So Naaman goes with all his horses and chariots and he goes to Elisha's house. But Elisha sends a messenger out to him. He's humbling him, right? Like, he goes to the king, then the prophet, and he gets the prophet's messenger. And he says, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." This, by the way, is the same river that Jesus was baptized in. But Naaman is ticked. He's like, I thought he would surely come out to me and call on the name of the Lord his God. And he thought he was going to do magic, right? Like abracadabra or something, and I'd be cured of my leprosy. And then he starts saying, "Look, we got better rivers in Syria. Look at this thing. It's full of mud," which by the way it is. "The rivers, they're better than all the waters of Israel. I could wash them and be cleansed." So he's going to leave. And Naaman's servant went off and finds him and says, "Listen, if the prophet had told you to do something great, you know, bring back the scalps of 1,000 bad dudes, you would have done it. How much more then when he tells you, go wash and be cleansed?" So he goes down and he does it. He washes 7 times as the man of God told him, and he becomes a new creation. His flesh becomes like that of a young boy. Now Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God, and he said, "Now I know there is a God, and there is no God in the world except Israel. Please accept a gift from your servant." Which, by the way, he doesn't accept. So here's what I want you to see. He goes there in power, right? He's trying to use all the connections that he's got to get what he wants. And that is the first thing that has to go. That's the first thing that has to go. And finally, when he hits rock bottom because he realizes he has no other options, he is baptized. and he comes out a new creation. Now, why did I use the word baptized there? Because that's what Jews did, what you just saw. If you want to be a part of God, then you've got to be a part of the people of God. Starting with Abraham and his family, this is what people have done. They have identified with God's saving activity. This is the God who delivered the slaves from Egypt. And when you get baptized, you are saying, I want to be a part of that because I can't do this on my own. So Naaman's not a Jew, and he's baptized. And at the end of that, he's like, now there is no God. That's the classic Israel thing. There's only one God, and it's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So when you're baptized, you're going through the same waters that the people who were in slavery. This is something that happens for everyone who wants to do it. You are identifying with people who are saying, we need saving. We need saving from our own slavery. Okay, so this is important because in the Bible Belt, there are a lot of people who are religious, and maybe you know them and you think, I don't want to be anything like them. The problem with Christianity, especially when in a place like the South for the last couple of decades, everyone's identified as Christian, is if you think baptism and then living a moral life is what this is, then you're missing it. Because you can't get real change from giving people rules. The thing about the Bible is brutally honest about human beings. It's not a religious book. In fact, it's clear in the New Testament, religion hasn't been able to do it, at least not religion the way we think. Because the very best religious people have had affairs at this point in 2,000 years ago. As the Hebrew people are reading their Bible, they're seeing the very best people had affairs, killed people, stole, lied, and ultimately they even killed God. These are the very best religious people. The Bible, the distinction in the Bible is not between sinners and non-sinners. It is between self-aware and self-deluded. Okay, so this is what Paul says in Romans 5, and that's where we're going to spend a little bit of time. Therefore, as sin entered the world through one man, talking about Adam, and death through sin, in this way, death came to all people because all people sinned. We are all, in other words, descendants of, is it? Still not, it's not working now, is it, at all? Okay. I think it did. We're all descendants of Adam and Eve, and human history is a story of rebellion against God. Everybody goes their own way, no matter what the cost, and there always is a cost. Okay, so then Paul is trying to lay out a different way of being human in chapter 5. Death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who is a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. The gift is different than the trespass. If many died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that come through the grace of the one man, King Jesus, overflow to the many? So this is different. It is a new way of being human, one that you can't earn, one that you can't, it is one that you can only respond to. One that you can only receive. And how do you respond to this? Well, here's what Paul does immediately after. What shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? By no means. We are those who have died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? Or don't you know, and this is where he's getting into his baptism theology, that all of us who were baptized into King Jesus were baptized into his death. We have died to sin because we were baptized into King Jesus, into his death. We were buried with him through baptism into death in order that just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may live a new life. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. So there is a union in baptism that happens. There's a union because Jesus was baptized. So you could be united with him. We're united with him in his death and also united with him in his resurrection. Our old self was crucified with him so that the body ruled by sin, those desires that are disordered, that we care about disproportionately, are being crucified, done away with, that we should no longer be. And this is where you see, Paul is talking about the Exodus. We're no longer slaves to sin. Because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. Therefore, if we die with Christ, we believe we'll live with him. For we know that Christ was raised from the dead. He cannot die again. Death no longer has mastery over him. The death he died to sin once and for all. But the life he lives to God. In the same way, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God in King Jesus. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal bodies so that you obey its evil desires. Thanks, Josh. So here's what he's trying to say. He's saying, this is Paul doing the Christian, baptism is the Christian exodus, right? Here's what's happening when you're baptized. You are acting out the gospel. You are acting out the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus. You're acting out the gospel. Now, here's the thing. When we think of acting out stuff, do you realize how much this story is in your bones? There's so many scenes in movies of this kind of stuff. Transformation. It just happens all the time. And it doesn't happen in church, so you don't think that's what it's talking about. But it's talking about a moment of a before and after. So I'm going to kill the lights and show you one of these. Okay, what movie was that? All right. So, in this moment, Andy, who has been falsely imprisoned, is finding his way through freedom, right? And that is a transformation baptism scene that is marked before and after. This is in our bones. There's a reason why we keep telling this story, because this is the human heart. A desire for freedom, sometimes a desire for freedom from ourselves, for a new start, for transformation. The problem is that we miss the rest of what Paul says. Paul says baptism is the Christian exodus, but in the Exodus story, seven times, God says, "Let my people go." We all are big on freedom, but we think freedom from Paul in the Exodus story. Every time God says, "Let my people go," he says, "so they may worship me."